It's funny how you register with imprints. I think the first time the word Knopford ever registered on my mind was on Spengler's Decline and Fall of the West. It's published over here by Knopf. That's a long, long time ago. I mean, it's quite a legendary name. But I was amused to see a New American Library. That's quite smart and businesslike, sort of open plan arrangement.
Your paperback house?
Well, not really. Really, that's Berkeley. But originally I was published over here by NAL Signet Books when it was owned by Victor Wainwright. Mm-hmm. And his son-in-law was Mac Talley, and he was my first editor. A very nice, avuncular man, gave me good advice. He switched around all the titles of my books, but he published them decently and cared about me. And then they got bought up by Times Mirror and became more public, and they ceased to take any interest in their authors and took much more interest in the building they were in. And I know my wife came over with me one year. We went to see them, and they had just moved into, or they were part of the J.C. Penney building, if that's what it's called. And it was very elegant, with plants on every windowsill and static electricity everywhere. They hadn't licked that problem in those days. And I remember Margaret going over to the window and the girl screaming, "Don't touch that geranium!" And Margaret immediately got a shock from the geraniums. And I thought, this is what high-tech really means, when you get a shock off a geranium. Now, of course, they've beaten that problem. They don't have static problems. They have it here. They have it here in this old run-down building.
I have it in my apartment here. Maybe. I can touch a geranium and I get shocked.
Yeah.
Just touch a wall, you wouldn't think you'd get shocked touching a wall. But you...
Well, you have a lot of free energy in the United States. We don't have it back home.
Well, I also use the computer a lot, and they say that you have to be very careful with a piece of electricity touching your computer, because there's all sorts of data.
Yeah.
So I'm very fearful about that, because I have everything I own is somehow registered in the computer.
Oh, well, I know, yes. We have three desks. I've got a large study at home. And one has got an old, simple, finger-driven typewriter, an old Hermes. And the other desk has got a nice electronic new Olivetti. That's fine. The third desk is my wife's, and she works with a word processor. And every now and then she loses something, and that's secretly rather pleasing.
Well, although I've had this computer for a year, I still have my old Remington, the Smith Corona. I used to have a Remington brand. I have an old Smith Corona manual, portable typewriter that I keep. And my wife said, "Well, why don't you take that to our storage room?" And I said, "No, you know, one of these days the lights will go,
yes.
And the computer will go."
Yes, that's right. There's a certain pleasure in working on that thing. Also, I'm a great one for having paper around, and different coloured paper. You get a lot of tactile pleasure out of that. When it's all behind glass, something goes to my mind. I mean, it's bad enough sitting there, you know, not doing anything else, but at least have a little paper to rustle.
Hang on a second.
But you've been here how long?
Well, I've been here 3 weeks.
Well, I mean, of course you're ready to go.
It means that a lot of drink and talk has gone under the bridge, and slowly my short-term memory gets wiped out. I can feel it. So it's no good asking me the title of my last book. I'm relying on you.
Well, the Heliconia series is no problem. I can, those are easy. Although you...
Oh, even I remember that.
You threw me a curve, though. You and I talked 2 years ago. I can give you the exact date, because I have a computer printout of all of my interviews, so I know where I can find them and get my old tapes out and sort of... But I could have sworn you told me that the third and final volume of the trilogy was going to be Heliconia Autumn. I must have just imagined it.
The printout jumped. I worked very happily with Athenaeum. They were quite happy to allow me English spelling inside the book and all this kind of thing. But had I done that volume, I think someone would have said, "Brian, it should be called Heliconia Fall," which to my mind has all kinds of religious connotations that I didn't want to get into. Also, being...
Autumn is a prettier word.
Well, it's a much prettier word, but actually, I mean, the other reason was that I have a very simple mind. I could visualize a trilogy as a kind of triangle. I couldn't visualize a quadrilateral. And so I'm glad I let myself off that fourth book.
I have a feeling that I got the heliconia on from some publicity material.
Oh, that's possible. I mean, another goof was that someone was running around saying there was going to be something called Arctic heliconia. I never had that plan. I don't know where that could happen. But, I mean, it's logical to assume that if Favaldi had four seasons, why shouldn't I? Seems logical, doesn't it?
Well, you created heliconia. I think you can create the seasons for it. How does it feel now, having now that you have finished this this long trilogy, although I think winter is shorter than the others, but how do you feel now, since this came out last year, having all this behind you?
I'm not sure that it actually is behind me mentally. I left that planet with great regret. I loved being on heliconia. And I've still not quite got away from it. And I was convalescent, really, because they represented three major creative efforts. Each novel is rather different in flavour from the other one. And so when I finished it at the beginning of last year, I thought that I wanted to work on something that would require application rather less than creativity. And so I started revising my history of science fiction, Benigni Esprit. And yet somehow the mere act of starting a new book acted as a terrific charge. And I felt, oh, I could write anything. And I then started writing three other books simultaneously. It's crazy. And they all went very well, all going simultaneously. But it turned out that Benigni Esprit was such a large task that they gradually ground to a halt, and they're on the back shelf at the moment.
Your focus now is on the Benigni Esprit.
Well, I actually came over with the manuscript of Benigni Esprit. I flew over on a Tuesday morning early, and on Monday evening at 7:30, I was still kneeling on the floor, doing all the pagination and getting three typescripts together and putting on the automatic number and everything, and finding to my horror that I had 890 typescript pages, which by my estimation is something like 270,000 words. More than I'd meant to write, you might say. But if you look at it this way, for good or worse, almost half the science fiction ever published has been published since 1970. It's phenomenal. No one understands exactly what it means, whether we're the success of the century, or whether it means that the writing is getting worse and it's more popular. And I thought that someone ought to come along and try and understand and synthesize what was going on.
I want to ask you some questions about science fiction, but before we do, let's work in Seasons in Flight, because that's your most recent book. In fact, I believe heliconia is represented in one of the stories there, isn't it?
Yes, that's right. Well, you know, on this long haul, actually 6 or 7 years writing, you need some diversion, I think, to just to keep you fresh now and again. So every so often I would stop everything and go away and walk in the garden and then write a short story. And I thought perhaps I could do things about heliconia in short story form that I couldn't do within the very large, tightly structured recipe of the novel. I could do a little side dish on the side. That was the idea of that. I only did one. Perhaps I'll do more later.
Well, the short stories are very interesting. They have the feeling of being fables, or folk tales. And I know this is a deliberate literary approach that you took with these stories, and you certainly did create that flavor. There's another, maybe you can comment on this, there's another common theme in addition to the one story dealing with heliconia. All of these stories take place in faraway lands, some identifiable, some struck me as being Eastern Europe, perhaps India, or Asia. Indonesia. I mean, it was very hard to pinpoint exactly where these stories were, but you gave me an idea approximately where in the world they were. But the thing that ran all the way, the thing that joined all these stories, I think, is the fact that they take place in faraway lands, primitive lands, and places that are very mysterious. Mm. Well, maybe you can comment on my comment.
I could give you two answers. Let me give you the more difficult answer. Firstly, I should say that most of the settings in there are places I have visited. All the story began in a place I visited, from Sumatra to Czechoslovakia. And I did want that kind of fabulous form. But I am a kind of spiritual exile. I know that sounds rather pretentious, but that's the way I'm constructed. There were various breakages in my life as a child, breakage of continuity in life. And these, I think, were accentuated by the fact that I went out to the Far East at the age of 17 and spent 4 years there. Seeing a whole lot of different climates and countries, and it made a very powerful impression on me. I liked being there so much. I thought it was wonderful, and instead of feeling myself exiled, I felt myself very much at home. I liked to see the sun come up to zenith. Whatever else bad was going on, at least every day the sun came up to zenith. And the curious thing was that when eventually I went back to England, then I was in exile. The war was over, new things were starting. I had left practically as a child. I couldn't even remember what the coinage was about. I really hadn't any friends. I had to go to another town. I went to Oxford to get a job of work. And really it was a period of considerable disorientation when I passed for a native. But I wasn't really. And I've never lost that feeling. And I think I've never lost a feeling for those faraway, mysterious lands, as you call them. So that it's I find it easier to write that sort of thing than to write a contemporary novel set in England.
Were your parents in the Foreign Service? Is that why you...
No. The war was still on. I joined up at the age of 17. It would be 1943, and you did a basic training, and then you were shipped to somewhere or other. In my case, I was shipped out to India and Burma, and that's a time of life when you're most impressionable.
And there you stayed until you went to school. College?
No. I'd been to school. I'd spent 10 years in various parts of school.
Just tell me, just briefly, in a nutshell, give me the chronology. You had indicated that you were out of England for so long that you came back almost as a stranger. But I kind of lost threads there. So if you could just give me a little chronology of your life, so I have you put you in perspective.
Well, it's simply that in those days, one was called up into the forces in wartime.
You grew up until you were 17. You grew up in England.
Yes, I did. Yes, but we did have this family dislocation where we were uprooted from where we lived, and we had to go and live in another part of the country. There were already various dislocations in my life, most of which I didn't like, but the major one, being in the Far East, I did. I found I liked very much. Made a great impression on me. And I think there's a kind of acceptance is not quite the word. Well, there's a kind of acceptance of what life gives you that I got from the East, which is in my stories. I'm sometimes accused of being very negative, but that's not the way I see it. I think there's a certain way in which you can accept your role in life and then work from within to do the best that you can with that role, and that seems to me the way that, shall we say, a Hindu would accept it. It would be, what's the term, karma.
Have you read the work of Malcolm Bossy, the warlord, and he's got a brand new novel with the title, which I just interviewed him the day before yesterday. I've forgotten the title. I won't forget the title by the time I get it on the air.
Okay, how's he spell
it? Bossy, B-O-S-S-E. But you have this preoccupation with the Far East, and he certainly does. It's an area, although he was born in Illinois, he has journeyed as a youth. He journeyed in the Merchant Marine in, I think, 1946, first year. He went to the Far East. He lived in Madras. He's traveled all over China. And his last two books are sequels. The first one is The Warlord, and the other, the thick books. But what he has done, I just tell you this parenthetically, because I think you might enjoy reading his work, because he is so overwhelmed, captivated by the Far East. He writes very vividly of it, places he has seen. He's gone over there as a Fulbright lecturer, and he goes every chance he gets. In fact, he was showing me his hand. He says, see this hand? He says, his hand is a spot. He said, this is a parasite that I got in India. This parasite will move from one point of my hand to another point of my hand. And he says, I had talked to a doctor in China about, or Japan, about getting it out. The doctor thought it might damage the tendons, but as long as the parasite didn't hurt anything, he thought that it would be all right for the parasite just to reside in the palm of his hand. So he said, this is the way the Middle East, or the Far East, is. Area of the world always living on the edge, where you can go and find yourself captured by a parasite. Anyway, I just throw this out parenthetically. It had nothing to do with our conversation as such.
Yes. But presumably that parasite could live there for 3 or 4 years before it finally surfaces in a mature form. I've heard of such things. Yes, I think it's quite likely. Yes.
I would personally risk the tendon damage. I don't want to see it moving in my hands.
Well, I mean, he may like it as a symbol. I think that it's confined to my hand. I wouldn't mind. I'd be quite interested to see this thing moving around. Wouldn't mind that too much.
Well,
depend what it was going to turn into when it came out. I mean, there are these things that you can get that stay in your body, and they may surface in the most inconvenient places. You don't quite know when. If he's got a kind that confines itself to his hand, it's a relatively reasonable parasite. But I agree. I felt that somehow life and death were enormously close, like a copulating couple, and that life, because of that, seemed much more intense. That's how I felt. And that the life I remembered in England was somehow lukewarm and less vivid. If it's hot all the time and you're sweating, your ambience increases, your psyche seems to expand, and conversely, in the cold northern winters, it shrinks and contracts. Part of our literary civilization is because it was cold all winter. You know, people stayed in. Think of Ibsen sitting in his little hut writing to a candle. If he'd been an Italian, we wouldn't have had the dramas of Ibsen. It's culturally, it's very good for us to have those cold winters.
Yeah, I can understand what you're saying. Obviously, a cold climate keeps people more immobile and less exploratory. And these other areas like India, parts of China, even Latin America, South America, Africa, I haven't been to all of these places, but the places I have been in this hemisphere, they strike me as colorful, noisy, many sounds, activity. That, of course, I get a lot living in Manhattan. I have a lot of this. This is a very busy city, but I've lived in more placid environments in this country. So I think I know what you're saying, that the heavily civilized, if you, I don't know if that's a good phrase, areas of the world, such as ours, the colder ones, there does seem to be somewhat less activity. And I can see why some people would be attracted to the sound and color you would find in other places.
Yeah, everything seemed more vivid to me. Of course, a lot of those places have changed so radically in the last 30 years. They're really quite different. The Somerset Maugham Malaya thing, I think, has almost disappeared. When I was in Sumatra, it was a place of beautiful sunsets, and the chief town there, Medan, where I lived for about 6 months, was a place of beautiful trees and shade. It was a quiet place. The bullock carts rattling around here and there. Really underpopulated, like a large village. I thought it was marvelous. Finally, after 30 years, I got to go back there, and I thought it was just terrible. It was just, you could see really the whole difficulty of the world. It was so overpopulated and over-mechanized, swarming with people, all of whom were buzzing about on little three-wheeled vehicles, where the hooter was attached to the accelerator in some magical way. The racket was awful, pollution was awful, and you know, these were people who had gained their independence from their colonial masters, the Dutch, and had looked forward to a good independent future. And I felt that their future was dreadful. I felt like a time traveler. And I suppose that they live very much in the present. None of them knew how it was. Indeed, I met some people there, and I said, well, you know that this place was once a Dutch colony. And some of them did remember that, but they didn't remember that the British had been there, or that the Japanese had been there during the war. It was erased. It was obviously nothing that they were ever taught, and they were just living in this, I thought, very uncomfortable prison.
It goes to show you that outside of one or two things, which we don't have to talk about, there's very little that is better the second or third time around.
Yes, yes, maybe so, but I'll tell you one story about walking around Medan, which I did. I actually found a place where I used to go, and I had a friend used to go and visit there. But the one thing that had remained unchanged and not renamed for political reasons or whatever was just the same, was the old Deli Cinema, DELI, that's the name of the local river, and it was still grinding out the same old, highly coloured, rubbishy fantasy films that it did back in the 40s. I thought it was so funny that the most ephemeral thing, some rubbishy fancy, the shark eaters of the Java Seas, or whatever it's called, that this ephemeral thing should actually be the most permanent thing there that I could find. Very, very strange. People still wanted their fantasies.
Brian Aldiss, before we wrap up our chat, I wanted to ask you a few things about science fiction. And I know that with the republication of the Building Your Spree, we'll find out a lot in more detail. You published that book originally when?
It was 1972. So there's been a lot of change since then.
Well, I have not stayed in touch with science fiction as well as I should. I, in my teenage years, in the 50s, I was an avid science fiction reader, and I look back at the science fiction writers that I loved, and many of them introduced me to literature on a wider scale. One of the writers who did that was Ray Bradbury, who has been able to transcend the science fiction genre, and indeed has written books, novels, and short stories. As a matter of fact, he wrote the screenplay for Moby Dick and has moved into other areas.
Yes.
tell me about how science fiction has changed. I know what it was like. I feel like I'm in a time warp in some respects. Mm. Outside of a number of writers who have cut through, for example, you are not exclusively a science fiction writer. Your Heliconia trilogy can be equated, in my mind at least, I could be corrected on this, but in my mind it could be equated with the work, some of the work by Richard Adams and by Tolkien. So you've cut through the science fiction genre yourself. I'd like to know how you see science fiction as changing since I became aware of it in the 1950s.
The 1950s was a very good time for science fiction. I liked it a lot then. There were magazines like Galaxy and F&SF that published some very sharp stuff. People like Ray Bradbury, Robert Sheckley, Frederick Pohl, a lot of good writers. But since then, of course, it was then almost a kind of secret movement that was part of the pleasure of reading it then. To know the name of Ray Bradbury was to be a member of a small elite. Now things have changed, particularly I think since the success in the mid-60s of Tolkien's Lord of the Rings and of the first Dune novel from Frank Herbert, where there you might think extraordinary preoccupations with respectively philology and ecology won them a very wide audience. It was not the generic science fiction, the real hard genre stuff, that won a wide audience. It was rather the exceptional book. And
they're also different, and you are certainly in this category. I should have mentioned Frank Herbert, just died, in fact.
Yeah.
All of you are consistent in one respect. You all have created your own worlds.
Yes.
As opposed to... I think more and more writers are doing that. I get a lot of the paperback science fiction, and many of the writers' names are not familiar to me, but I get the impression that there is a lot of imitation going on. And as a result, a lot of these other writers are also trying to create... Anna Caffrey, I think, is another one. Trying to create these worlds. I don't know how successful... they are, but that is a change, because it seems to me in the 50s there were planets. I mean, people went out and explored planets. Asimov certainly did it with his Foundation series.
Didn't
seem to me that they created the worlds as in such fine detail as later became apparent.
Well, one way in which you can approach this is to say that, for instance, the whole format of publishing science fiction has changed. For instance, currently, there's a science fiction novel by Gene Orr called The Mammoth Hunters, which has 1.2 million hardcover copies in print. 5 years ago, that would not have happened. Suddenly, people are buying hardcover SF in bulk.
I'm not sure that's considered science fiction.
Well, I consider it a science fiction, whether you like it particularly or not. I think Gene Orr thinks that it's science fiction. And
critics in this country compare it to the comic strip Alley Oop.
No comment. I don't know what you can say about this. I think that in actual fact, science fiction has become diluted. There's more fantasy and less what I regard as SF. And perhaps Mammoth Hunters is more that kind of thing. But this seems to be because, A, it was always difficult to write good science fiction. You had to be disciplined. And it's easier to write fantasy. Anything can happen. And B, since there's such a demand, you have to fill in with a lot of fantasy. So that there are publishers who have science fiction lists by title, but on the whole, they are fantasy books. And fantasy, I think, is much more escapist, than SF. So there is an increasing demand for large blocks of prose. Don't ask me why. Although if you did, I suppose I'd say, well, the main audience for that kind of thing is teenage, and the teenagers have time. They've generally got time. They can read however many books there are in the Dune series. Is it 7? They have time to read all that. As you get older and you get involved in a work situation, marriage, etc., etc., you haven't got the time to spend that you had. And so, like everything else, there's a good and a bad side to it. There are some writers who can use that space creatively to show you historical processes, and others who just go ahead and imitate their previous book.
I wonder, I pull this out as a speculation, you're in a better position to comment on this than I, but you mentioned that there are more fantasy elements in science fiction today, and less SF, as you put it. I wonder if that's because many of the SF elements have become reality. Now, we now have spaceships, we now have shuttles, permanent space capsules, or the Russians who started one. We have computers, and we have television sets you can wear on a wrist, and all of these things. So I just wonder, since so many of the science elements have been fulfilled since science fiction began to be written, that maybe fantasy has become more dominant. Is that an accurate assessment?
Well, let me tell you this, that your summing up is one that a lot of science fiction writers would like to evade and deny and say it is not so, and that there are always new frontiers being opened up by science. But on the contrary, I believe there's a lot in what you say, in as much as the new discoveries are much harder to dramatize effectively than the old. It was easy for Edgar Rice Burroughs to explore Mars, and Mars had a kind of immediacy in people's imaginings. Similarly, well, the whole concept of spaceflight could be imagined, and it could be dramatized, and it had vivid trademarks. The man in the spacesuit, the phallic symbol type spaceship, they were immediately identifiable. Now, I'm fascinated by Voyager 2. I think it is beyond doubt the triumph of technology of the 20th century. There is the small spacecraft operating on less power than our digital watch, sending back this fantastic data on Uranus. To me, that is absolutely wonderful. It's all the kinds of things I dreamt about when I was a boy and was an astronomy nut. And yet, how can I write a story dramatizing some kind of going on Uranus? I cannot do it. Maybe a younger writer could, who has some fantastic new idea, but you can't really visualize life on Uranus or a spaceship landing there. Well, you can visualize it, but there's not much that you can say about that that really hasn't already been said. So then you maybe think of an inhabited planet has to be beyond the solar system, so it's some light years away, and that immediately takes away the nearness of the story, because you've got to set it willy-nilly further in the future. The immediacy of the thing is vitiated. So I think that in that respect, science fiction does have it harder than we did in the 50s, and in that respect, it is, one option is to go into fantasy.
You said something very, very interesting. Can't remember exactly how you phrased it, or maybe you were quoting someone. But these scientific changes, when I said that I felt that we are fulfilling a lot of these scientific dreams, doesn't mean that we won't go further and further, but you don't see them as vividly. For example, I'll give you two examples that I think are interesting. Maybe you can confirm what I say. I mentioned my computer a minute ago. It has been upgraded 3 times.
Yeah.
It does fantastically more work than it did a year ago because of its upgrade, but it looks exactly the same. They put new chips in it. The technology of that computer has been improved 100 times,
yeah,
but you can't see any difference.
Uh-huh.
I'm researching a story that was to take place in 1948. I have a whole bunch of copies of Good Housekeeping, Collier's of Saturday Evening Post. One had an advertisement for the most modern kitchen of the day. And I looked at that photograph, or several photographs, showing a mother and her child in this beautiful kitchen that looked exactly as though it is a kitchen of today. It is, but in closer inspection, you notice that there was no dishwasher. There was no microwave. There was a refrigerator that looked pretty much like today's refrigerator, but probably had a tiny freezer, if that. Yes. And there was certainly
no ice maker.
There were none of these things, but the kitchen looked the same. I mean, at first glance, it looked exactly the same. Mm. So all of the changes in the kitchen were scientific changes, but not structural changes. Yeah. So that's what I meant when these scientific advances become fulfilled, the changes are not vivid, perhaps. You feel them, and you sense them, and you benefit from them, but you don't see them as much.
Yes, that's interesting. The other thing is, of course, that there was a time when things seemed to be getting bigger and better. Now they get smaller and better. You know, we do seem to internalize these things, that the number of things that a digital watch can do is absolutely amazing. They don't get any bigger.
Yeah,
it's like your computer, you pack more and more things in there.
My stereo gave out, and I had to take it over to the repair shop, and I've had it for about 10 years, and it's a big, heavy thing. Yeah. They're making them half the size. Mm. But when I went over to complain about having to carry this thing, because it weighed, I don't know, it must have weighed 20 pounds. Mm. I carried it in, and I complained to the repair shop man about the weight and the size, and he said, you know, I could go out and buy one now, but a fraction of the weight and a fraction of the size. He said, but it's not any better. He says, you have one of the best machines made, even though it's bigger, and it has some mechanical switches and knobs and things, where everything else is computerized or digitalized or whatever.
Yeah.
So, anyway, we're getting a little off the track.
No, but I think it's an interesting point. It hadn't occurred to me. I think it's just so that the pattern of the future was preset, and what we're now doing is filling in the detail, as it were.
Science fiction. You said something very interesting at the beginning of our conversation, before I think we had this on tape, or maybe I did have it rolling. But you said something to the effect that more science fiction has been written since 1970 than all of the science fiction put together prior to that time. Is that accurate?
Well, I've checked it with Charlie Brown, who's the editor of Locus, the magazine of the science fiction field, and he agrees that that is so. But it's just like saying there are more scientists now alive than have ever lived in the history of the Earth. I mean, it's just a quantitative fact. I forget how many books are published now, but it's a plethora. No one can read them all, except me. I've read them all.
Yes, you have. Where is the best science fiction being written in the English language today?
You're begging me to say the USA. Well, it's clearly my own work. That's the answer. You see, it's an interesting case of America taking something that originated elsewhere in Europe, and in particular in England, and making it indigenous. I think by the end of this century, you'll see that science fiction is almost entirely a United States product. I mean, I say it with some regret, but one has to be a realist. This is what I think is happening. There don't seem to be new writers coming along in England, or if they are, they are no longer catching an international audience. And if you go to any other industrial culture, like West Germany, for instance, you'll find the racks full of science fiction, beautifully packaged, very fine covers, and it's almost all translations from Anglophone novels. Almost all of it. There are a few writers in West Germany, I mean indigenous ones, but their names are not very well known, and they don't sell as many copies as all the writers that we're familiar with over here. It has the stamp of America on it, just the way popular music did in the 30s, or the cinema did in the 40s. It has become an American product. It's now an American literature and a part of the things that go on here. It's American as apple pie, which you know originated in England too.
I didn't know that, but...
American will ever believe that.
No, it's hard to believe. Well, to kind of wrap things up, still on the theme of science fiction, while you say that science fiction is now an American export, it is not heavily reviewed in this country in what few forums remain for reviewing books. And indeed, there seems to be a certain contempt for science fiction as a whole by literary critics who believe that it consists of substandard writing. Now, with your voluminous research into this, can you comment on that and confirm the accuracy or inaccuracy of that assertion?
Well, you're asking me two questions. First of all, with any kind of commercial writing, most of it is rubbish. We understand that. It's derivative and it simply relies on the last thing that was a success. We understand this with the movies. We have to understand it with a popular medium like science fiction. But the other thing to say is about those literary critics that I would say that I'm tolerably well versed in the modern novel as well as science fiction, and a lot of that is very poor, and some of the poor stuff wins literary prizes and is applauded. And perhaps one of the reasons it's applauded is because it only sells 2,000 copies in hardcover. There is an elitism about reading that kind of fiction. At least science fiction is very democratic. You have to realize that literary critics in your country, just as in England, have a kind of unwritten maxim that says whatever is good cannot be popular and whatever is popular cannot be good. That is their a priori concept on which they work. So they'll never like science fiction. They'll never like it. You can't persuade them. There's no rational argument. And at any time they don't want to like it, they can go out and buy the dozen nearest things in a bookshop and prove that 8 or 9 or 10 of them are pretty awful. It's not surprising.
Well, critics also tend to like personal themes or stories dealing with human interrelations, and I think there is a feeling that science fiction somehow doesn't do this as well as, say, Updike. And your stories, they're not in Seasons in Flight. They're not all really science fiction, except two, I think. One that takes place, I think, with the plane landing after the nuclear war, the American plane landing,
and the gods in flight.
Yeah, and the other one, the hell of the one about the set on Heliconia. Mm-hmm. But there's certainly I'm not expressing myself very well. I'm almost out of tape too, but they're not anything like John Updike, who deals primarily with people who live in suburbia and their marital problems. And
sure.
Achiever was like that too. And that seems to be favored to a degree by critics.
Let me say before your tape runs out that I'm very impatient with that argument, because at the basis of all my books are human relationships. They don't take place in the suburbs, but I think they're very imaginatively alive. But it's no good arguing. This argument will go on forever. They won't like it. We just have to go on writing it.
Please do, so we can talk again. Brian Aldiss, thank you very much.